Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 14, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two guests, both of us joining in the studio tonight. Both of them joining us in the studio tonight. No crummy phone lines to cope with. Tariq Ali, first up. Well, he's got a couple of new books out. One on a series of interviews with David Barsamian, and also a reissue of his memoir of street fighting in the 1960s. But we'll talk to him about a variety of topics, as we have many times in the past. And then at the bottom of the hour, Matt Taibbi will be joining us. Matt's got a new book out. Matt, columnist with New York Press. But he's got a collection of some of his stuff and some new writing about his coverage of the 2004 presidential campaign called Spanking the Donkey. Dispatches from the Dumb Season, just out from the New Press. And before we get to all that, a look at the news headlines. First, this morning, the Department of Labor reported that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, the very sensitive, timely indicator of the state of the job market, fell by 10,000, second consecutive weekly decline. So the spike that began in late February upwards now has been partly reversed. So this is a suggestion of a moderately healthy labor market, but not one in the of it robust health. A somewhat more gloomy point of view coming from the ABC News Washington Post weekly reading of consumer attitudes. That now down very hard, down to minus 18, down 11 points in just a little over a month. A very sharp decline, and one of the sharpest declines in the history of this series, which goes back about 20 years. Consumers seem to be worried about the stumbling job market and high gas prices, but also there seems to be a general discontent about the state of the economy and economic policy showing up in the polls. Although I just did this experiment yesterday, if you graph George Bush's approval rating and the price of a gallon of gas together, you'll find that they're an almost perfect mirror image. For the statistically minded, the correlation coefficient is minus 0.81. The price of gas seems to be on lots of minds now, and not to George Bush's benefit. Also, yesterday, the Commerce Department reported that retail sales were up just a measly 0.3% in March, and that was pushed higher by gasoline prices. If you take out gasoline, it was actually down a tenth of a point. Also, a somewhat strong performance, reasonable performance in the auto market, but consumption slowing down a bit. So we have a combination of what seems to be a stumbling job market, not doing great, not falling apart by any means, but not doing great, and rising interest rates making borrowing a little less attractive. So we need a stronger job market in this country if we want consumption to continue. But if consumption continues, that brings into play the other chronic problem, the trade balance, which was reported earlier this week, took an enormous, is now a minus $61 billion, imports exceeding exports by $61 billion in the month of February. If you look at it in the chart, it's been just heading straight down for as long as anyone can remember, and it's certainly partly a result of higher oil prices increasing the U.S. imports, but also just about everything else. China, U.S. has a $14 billion trade deficit with China. That's almost a quarter of the total. And we're pretty much alone in the world in that regard. Most other countries have a balance with China or something approaching that. The United States, the only country really running a gigantic trade deficit with China. And for the source of that problem, go down to your nearest Walmart. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index is actually rolling over a little bit. So it was improving from January into mid-March, but now it's flat, and the latest week is rolling over a little bit. So not such a good sign for the U.S. economy. And with oil prices as high as they are, and interest rates rising, there is not much reason to expect a significant improvement as the year goes on. North of the border, Canadian labor market added just 4,400 jobs in March. Pretty disappointing. Canadian unemployment fell, but the Canadian job market has been stumbling also, like ours, in recent months. And then finally, the OECD, the official think tank sponsored by the rich countries based in Paris. It's a composite index of leading indicators for mostly the rich countries, although there are some less rich ones like Mexico included in it. Falling in the month of February and also portending a generally slowing global economy, not forecasting recession, but we see troubles in Western Europe, troubles in Japan, both what looked like embryonic recoveries in those countries last year now stumbling and not yet dead, but not thriving either. So that not looking good for the rest of the year either. And then finally, just about an hour ago, or maybe a little longer, the U.S. Congress passed the bankruptcy reform bill, something covered pretty closely on this show. It is really a reversal of several centuries of U.S. history, which has been historically very friendly. Our legal code has been pretty friendly to debtors and rather indulgent about allowing for bankruptcy since Millard Fillmore abolished bankruptcy, abolished debtors' prisons about 150 years ago. So it's not looking so good. This is a very mean bill. This is not a surprise, but it's going to make it much, much more difficult for people to file for bankruptcy. The bill was almost literally written by the credit card industry, and they've been fighting for it for 8 years. They've finally gotten what they want. Bush is almost certain, well, no, more than almost certain, is completely certain to sign it, and it will take effect in about 6 months. So as I don't often give financial advice on this show, but if you've got a credit card problem, you should check with a lawyer and contemplate filing bankruptcy now. The consequences are much less severe than you might imagine, and it's going to become much harder to do so in a few months. So please give that serious consideration. And we'll be back in just a moment to speak with Tariq Ali after this musical interlude. And that excerpt from Bach's Sonata for Solo Violin Number 1, first movement, performed by Sigiswald Kukin. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's the closest approximation I can come up with. And we'll hear a little bit more of that Bach solo violin music throughout the show. And now we're joined in the studio by Tariq Ali, who is a prolific author of nonfiction and fiction, a filmmaker, and all-around troublemaker. And he joins us in the studio. He's got a new book out, a collection of interviews with a competing radio interviewer, David Barsamian, which has just been published by the New Press, called Tariq Ali, Speaking of Empire and Resistance. And you've also got a reissue coming out from Verso very soon of your Street Fighting Man?
Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s.
And, okay, so I wanted to, since I was couldn't listen to your performance last night at the Cooper Union, but I was hosting or moderating a panel on Empire, I thought I'd ask you some questions about Empire myself.
Right.
It's kind of on my mind. You say somewhere in this book that Empire today means the United States, and I think that was from probably about 1999 or so that interview happened, but do you still think that? Is it really all about the United States?
I think it is, and I've been arguing now for some time against Ned Greenhalgh and their disciples that there is no silver lining. The empire today, if you talk about it, is the United States and its military power. And this enormous military might that the United States has accrued makes it the most powerful country by a long shot. You were talking earlier, Doug, about the deficit with China running into billions. This is true. But the Chinese spending on defense is $8 billion, which was the increase in the U.S. military budget of a couple of years ago. Just the increase is China's complete defense budget. And I think that the United States ruling elite has decided that they are going to use military force to defend their economic hegemony and standing in the world come what may, which is why they don't care, I don't think, about, you know, borrowing money and being in debt to Japan or China or things like that. They're going to do it like that. And there's no one to challenge them. In the old days, when you had empires, they were jostling for space, fighting wars with each other, getting colonies, getting their influence on other continents. The 20th, early 20th and late 19th century was a war between different empires. Well, that will not happen now because the United States is completely dominant in this field.
But the United States is having a bit of trouble subduing Iraq. I think Salon reported a day or two ago that there's been a cumulative total of something a little over a million U.S. soldiers have cycled through Afghanistan and Iraq together. And it's taken all those people to subdue two pretty poor, weak countries. So just how mighty is the United States? It could beat any conventional army in the world. There's no doubt about that. But can it beat stateless warlords or insurgents with IEDs?
Yeah, but these are people who, in my opinion, don't represent a serious challenge or a threat to the United States. They are awkward. I mean, Al-Qaeda, take that for instance. You know, 3,000-4,000 people who have the capacity to inflict damage, which is psychologically a blow for the United States. But it's like, you know, a gnat on an elephant's back. Basically, they can't inflict any serious economic, political damage or offer a way out for the world. So that is not, in my opinion, a serious threat. The serious threat potentially comes from people who they trade with and deal with, the two big blocs, the Far Eastern bloc and the European Union. Now, the European Union is so weak and miserable that it will never be a political entity in this, you know, unless it changes, unless it kicks out Britain and Eastern Europe.
And it looks like France is going to reject the Constitution.
It looks like that. And if that happens, it's a massive blow for the neoliberal economics which they were imposing on Europe. And one reason the French are so opposed to it, no, I mean not the French political class, but the ordinary French people, is they say they want to bring unemployment, privatization here to the same extent they've done in the United States and Britain, and it's not on, and they're going to use the European Constitution to do it. So I think they will be defeated.
American and British analysts are always exhorting the continent to be more like us, more Anglo-American or Anglo-Saxon, as they say, in France. But that doesn't seem to be too popular in the continent.
It's not popular on the continent.
So and, you know, 10% unemployment is not doing its persuasive work,
though. No, it isn't. And they know now that if they go down that road, it's the end of a whole number of traditions in the workers' movement, the labor movement, in the society and its culture as a whole. And they're just simply not prepared to go down that line. I mean, France is the one country where I think, I don't have the statistics on me, you have more strikes to reverse policies in any other advanced Western country. And 9 times out of 10, they win. The government caves in. And the reason it caves in, that this now goes beyond politics almost. That it's not simply the left. It's the left and the right and non-aligned workers who unite to get their way. And, I mean, recently Chirac was so scared by the thought that the French might vote the constitution out that he made a big demagogic speech saying, we are not going to, France will fight in the European Union to prevent Bulgarian plumbers from coming and taking jobs from our French at a quarter of their pay. We are not going to tolerate it. Well, he said it precisely because they were preparing to tolerate it, but it was an appeal to the, you know, trust me, it's not working.
As Claude Coburn says, never believe anything till it's officially denied, right?
Exactly.
But the EU doesn't seem like it ever present a credible economic or political or military rivalry to the United States. Is that correct?
I think that's absolutely correct. Whenever they on Iraq, they were not the EU, but some of the countries in the EU were very unhappy, the French and the Germans. But once the United States has occupied Iraq, they clambered on board, and the French actually collaborated with the United States in getting rid of an elected government in Haiti, removing Aristide from power and helping to occupy Haiti. It was a joint French-American operation, which people tend to ignore, but it's a very significant thing that that's happened. So I think the United States is the dominant power and will remain so in the foreseeable future. There's no challenge to it militarily.
And it was interesting how the French and Germans rolled over on the Wolfowitz nomination at the World Bank.
Completely. I mean, just another indication that when it comes to crunch time, they're not really prepared to cross the United States. And even when they were opposing the war on Iraq, they were desperate to be given some face-saving formula via the Security Council, or the Germans were. But when Bush didn't do that, then they upped the ante a bit and turned on the heat. But basically, they were quite prepared to collaborate and would have been collaborating even more had not a resistance sprung up in Iraq. That then made the Europeans say, well, look, we warned you about this. We told you. You went in. It's a mess. You're responsible for it. We stayed clear.
Speaking of that resistance, there's been a lot of talk in the American press and at least some of the British press that I look at that they've turned the corner in Iraq and the resistance is on the ropes and it's only a matter of time before American forces prevail there. What do you think of that?
I don't agree with that, Doug. This is wishful thinking. And the only reason they say that is because they managed to push through a half-baked election, where the South voted, but large swathes of the country didn't vote, and they thought that this would give them legitimacy. If you read Tom Friedman, New York Times, he said the reason this election is so important for us is now we can at last have a proper civil war in Iraq, i.e. let them kill each other, they won't touch us. Not working like that at all. 3 days ago, you had the largest political assembly in the history of certainly post-Saddam Iraq, which was 300,000 people gathered in the central square and burnt effigies of Bush and Blair and demanded an end to the occupation. Now, most of these people came from the Shias, who we are told are in general more collaborative. I don't think that this is true. I think what is taking place now is a jockeying for power within Iraq, and I think many of the people demonstrating and their leaders are extremely unhappy at what the United States is up to, which is what they've done all over the world, we shouldn't be surprised, is to have a friendly pro-U.S. government in power. So the new president of Iraq, Talibani, has taken money from the CIA, from Israel, from Saddam Hussein, from the Iranians, and Zalmay Khalilzad has now been dispatched from Kabul to make sure that Talibani does what the U.S. wants. The problem for them is that they won't get away with it necessarily. And if there's no sign of an end to the occupation, I think the resistance will continue and more people might even join it.
And what are the chances, do you think, that the new government will demand some kind of timetable for U.S. withdrawal?
They wanted to do that before the elections took place, and the United States told them that if they made that, or some of the groups made that into a demand that they wanted a withdrawal, there would be no election. So the groups called a press conference and said, none of us are demanding the withdrawal of American troops. Of course, subsequently, some of the Shia organizations, Muqtada al-Sadr in particular, are demanding the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops, but the new Kurdish president, Talibani, is saying he wants American troops to stay at least for another 2 years, and then we'll see how long we need them for. In other words, admitting to the world that without them I wouldn't be where I am.
And Poland, of course, withdrawing its troops by year end, and I saw in the Financial Times today that Britain is talking about withdrawing next year. Is this going to leave the United States stranded?
Well, Poland is withdrawing. Even Berlusconi is saying that he'll withdraw troops, Italian troops. The Spanish are already out. I think the British are making those noises because an election is impending, Doug. And the government are deliberately putting out these feelers to try and calm down the fervor against the war which exists in Britain, because they fear it's going to cost them in this coming election. Not that they think they'll lose, but that it'll reduce their majority. So these are the noises they are making to appease the anti-war segment of the population, which is pretty large. 56% of the population is totally opposed to the war and wants a withdrawal.
That's the voice of Tariq Ali, who a prolific author, and most recently a new press volume, a collection of his interviews with David Barsami and Conversations with Tariq Ali, speaking of empire and resistance. Let's talk a bit about that empire, that outpost of empire in the Middle East, Israel. You sometimes see it argued, like a counterpunch is a place that comes to mind, for example, is that the U.S. alliance with Israel has outlived its usefulness, that it was a relic of the Cold War. But now the United States could gain, in very cynical terms, from betraying Israel and trying to make friends in the Arab world. Do you buy that?
I don't totally buy that for the following reasons. The United States, of course, has had a cynical foreign policy, like all empires, and will always do so. I mean, it does what it believes is best in its own interests. We can argue whether this is the best way of even defending its own interests, but nonetheless, that is the basis of its policy, recently redefined by Condoleezza Rice. She said, we defend our interests. Fair enough, it's the truth. They only became really close to Israel after the Six-Day War in 1967. And another author, colleague of ours, Norman Finkelstein, has pointed out that prior to 1967, the U.S. was quite distant from Israel. It's the post-67 seeing Israel's prowess in defeating three Arab countries simultaneously that excited the United States, and they felt that this could be the most reliable relay we have in that region, the only force for stability in an oil-rich region. The others can't be depended on. I think that even though the Cold War is over, I think that still holds true, Doug. That the United States rulers believe that in the last analysis, if they need someone there, and they might, who knows what's going to happen in the world, which they've destabilized by occupying Iraq, then the Israelis are the only country they can rely on 100%. And I don't think they're going to break from that easily.
You also see in places like Counterpunch the argument made that it's really the American Zionist lobby and some mysterious hold that Israel has over U.S. politics that's responsible for this sort of support. Congress is Israeli-occupied territory, as one of the pieces in the Counterpunch collection put it. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I mean, we know. Why wasn't this the case then prior to 67? If there is some sort of synergy between these two forces, Zionism and the Zionist state in the Middle East and the American imperial ruling elite. I think they do it because they need to do it, and they feel that it's in their interest. I mean, the joke which Noam Chomsky and Finkelstein often make is that when the United States decides to ditch Israel, the whole of the United States will, everyone in the country will fall into line, and that Chomsky and Finkelstein will be the only people left criticizing the United States. But, I mean, the point is they could do it if they thought that defending Israel in the way they do, giving it a blank check to go and kill Palestinians week after week after week, is something which is not in their interests. If they felt that, they would break. I don't think that there's any big problems about that. It's true you have a very large Zionist lobby in this country, and its influence is way out of proportion to the importance of Israel. But this is a consequence of U.S. foreign policy, not its cause.
And then finally, let's turn a bit to your to Britain, British politics. Mm. There's an election coming up. I think you had a piece in The Guardian saying you're going to vote for the Liberal Democrats.
Well, come an election, Doug, and as I've often argued on this show before, you have to make choices. And my gut instinct is where the incumbents have waged war, told lies, broken international laws, and are regarded by large chunks of the world as war criminals, one can't vote for them. But it's not sufficient not simply to vote against them. It's important to vote for people who can defeat them. And in this case, my argument is very simple. Britain went to war illegally. It even massaged its own Attorney General's advice. 139 Labour members of Parliament, all the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists, the Welsh Nationalists, voted against the war. So my line is very simple. Defeat the warmongers in Parliament. That means every single Conservative, because no Conservative voted against the war. The Blairites, the new Labour gangs, and try and defeat them by voting for people who did actually vote against the war in the British Parliament. And I said, so you have to think strategically. You don't do the same thing in every region. You see who is capable from amongst the anti-war representation of defeating Blair. In my constituency, the Liberal Democratic candidate is second. She's a very staunch anti-war person. I've had many a conversation with her, and I hope she's going to win. So I said that publicly to break the tribalism that exists, especially on the left. Oh, we can't think of doing anything which, you know, we've not done before. It's a sort of herd mentality. And so I said this is a first British election after the Iraq war. We have to try and punish Blair. We might fail, but let's not say we never tried. Of course, it created a big, you know, debate, and I was denounced by many people saying, why have you done this, etc. But I defend that position. And interestingly enough, I had, after that article appeared in The Guardian, 200-plus emails, 99% of which were totally supportive from people I had no idea who they were. We've been thinking about these problems, too. We'll do it. And about 1% were hostile. Half were New Labour and half were from far-left sectarians.
Final question. What is in it for Blair and Britain in playing lapdog to George Bush in the United States?
It's a very interesting question. I don't think it's psychological, the reply. I think first is that Blair actually agrees with Bush. Basically, he is a neoconservative in his formation, in what he wants to do in the world. He believes in imperialism, in shifting. They give it a mask, call it names. But that's basically what he believes. We should go and sort out A, B, and C like we used to do before, except that his knowledge of history is so lamentable. He doesn't read books. First British Prime Minister not to have read a single book, according to his colleagues, that he has no idea what British history was or what Britain did. Someone once asked him privately, I mean, you should go easy on Iran. After all, we're responsible. We overthrew a democratically elected government in 1953, the government of, you know, we overthrew Mossadegh. And he said, who's Mossadegh? This is the British Prime Minister. So he genuinely shares many things with your president here, and they get on very well. In fact, we now know that Bush actually said to Blair, I know your country is opposed to the war, and we appreciate your support, and if you don't want to send British troops immediately, that's fine. We can manage on our own. And Blair said, no, our troops are going to go in. He's also, which people in the States probably don't know, a deeply religious figure, Tony Blair. So there's another similarity. And then the third argument, which I've the only sort of rational basis for it, is the fear that if Britain ever left the coattails of the United States can be very brutal in its dealings with allies, What is to stop them doing a deal with the single most important country in Europe, the Germans?
All right, that's going to bring it to a close. Thanks for joining us, Tariq Ali, and the latest book, Conversations with Tariq Ali, Speaking of Empire and Resistance, just out from the New Press, collection of interviews with David Barsamian, and also coming shortly from Verso, Street Fighting Years. An autobiography of the 1960s,
yeah.
with some new material in it as well.
With a lot of new material. In fact, I've written a 20,000-word introduction.
All right. Well, looking forward to that. And speaking tomorrow night at the opening of the Left Forum, CUNY Grad Center, 34th Street and 5th Avenue.
This is the successor to the Socialist Scholars Conference that once was.
All right. Well, I'll probably see you around the halls there.
Okay. Very
thanks
good
for joining
to be
us.
With you.
And let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Matt Taibbi.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead saying, whoop, whoop, we come and never pre-recorded, live and direct, it's just listener-supported on WBAI. Peace.
And the show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's take another little taste of the Bach solo violin music, and we'll be back with Matt Taibbi in about a minute. And that a little excerpt from the first violin sonata by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Sigiswald Kuchen. I'm probably brutalizing that name, but...
That's twice tonight. That's
yeah, right. Well, one more coming up, too. So I hope I don't get any nasty communications from him. Now we're joined in the studio by Matt Taibbi, New York Press columnist and author of a very fine new book, even though he doesn't think so, called Spanking the Donkey, Dispatches from the Dumb Season, his coverage of the 2004 presidential campaign, and also The Man Who Killed Santa Claus. But, I'm not going to explain that. You'll have to buy the book to find out why. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thanks a lot. First of all, why did you have me come on after Tariq Ali, man? I'm going to sound like a freaking idiot now on the show.
Don't worry about that.
I thought we were friends.
Variety of approaches here. I got to say, I always knew American political campaigns were stupid things, but your close-up view, there's certainly been other close-up views of American political campaigns, but it's just a savage reminder of how incredibly stupid the whole thing is. How did you survive it?
Well, I mean, there's a part in the book where it comes out pretty clearly that I almost didn't survive it. I mean, I actually became legitimately suicidal during one point of the trip, and I really started to lose my mind a little bit during one stretch where I was covering John Kerry for a while. I think there was a lot of other stuff going on in my life at the time, but it's also just an incredibly frustrating story to cover for a journalist because the way that the campaign is designed, it's really not possible to get anything except the angle that the campaign wants you to get out of it. Pretty much the candidate gets up there and he says his computer-generated speech. Then you are supposed to repeat it in print, and that's pretty much it. There's really no other angle to get. You don't have time to really see or talk to any other people that the campaign doesn't provide for you personally. So it's incredibly frustrating.
So there are no unguarded moments when the candidate is not on?
No.
Figure out what he or she is all about?
No, and again, you're so completely isolated. I mean, the isolation in the campaign is so total that the candidates have to get cigarettes smuggled in. If you're a smoker and you're a journalist on the campaign, you don't have time to go to a store. You don't have time to actually leave the confines of that one particular group of people that you spend all your time with, which is the other journalists, the aides who are in the plane, and the candidate himself. So those people are your world for the entire time that you're covering the story, and this can go on for months for some of those people. So they don't have any real perspective on what they're seeing, and the whole thing could really be done in a movie studio. You don't have to be traveling.
But then there's this intense deadline and competitive pressure about absolutely nothing of substance, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So what a very strange world that must be to be part of for several months.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And if it doesn't strike you, if you feel a little bit strange about it, as I did, there's a very big social aspect to being on the campaign, which is a problem. I mean, if you don't have the right orthodoxy, then you're shunned by some of the people on the plane, it becomes very stressful. So there's that factor too, which is when you're a journalist and you're covering things, you sort of subconsciously start doing what everybody else is doing just because it's easier to live that way. It just becomes harder to get along if you don't do the normal thing.
What were the other journalists like? I mean, were they at all critical of or distant from the process, or were they completely uncritically wrapped up in it?
Well, again, it's a little bit like you ever read books about Aum Shinriko or any of those cults?
No.
I mean, they intentionally, if you're in any one of those cults, one of the first things that they do is they try to make sure you don't have enough sleep. The cultists are always kept awake like about an hour and a half longer than a normal person would be, and they're just too tired to have any will to really oppose what they're doing. And that factor is definitely present in the campaign coverage. You're always a little bit under-rested. You typically would come in very late at night after being at all these different events, and you have to get up very early in the morning. So you get about 4.5-5 hours of sleep maximum. And everybody's works so hard that they don't really have time. There isn't any time to really reflect on what exactly it is that they're doing. It's purely a technical, clerical process of just listening to the gibberish that the candidate is muttering at any given moment, and then translating that back into your pieces 15 minutes later, and then moving on to the next event, and that's it.
But the stories are almost completely interchangeable from one week to the next, aren't they?
They're so interchangeable that you literally could do it not being there. And in fact, I have some suspicions about some journalists who actually did do that. I mean, if you look closely at a lot of the campaign coverage, you'll notice that the only people who are quoted are the candidate and aides, and perhaps somebody who was in the crowd, but even that is pretty rare. For the most part, it's the same rotating group of people who have been in your Rolodex since the very beginning of the campaign, and you can pretty much do it if you have a photographer telling you where the guy was and what the background of the speech looked like. You could just sit in an office somewhere and just crank that stuff out without having been there.
Then, of course, there's the de rigueur of Vox Pop. There's always one or two, people in the street quoted.
There's an interesting aspect to that as well. There's a couple of things about that are really interesting, which is that one of the things that I did as I started to watch what political orientation the people were who were being quoted in these Vox Pop surveys or just thrown in as men in the street. And one of the things you notice is that there's never a non-voter in any of these stories. There's never somebody who says, well, I'm not planning on voting, or I didn't vote in the last election. It's always someone who says, I'm either for Bush or I'm for Kerry. So again, America, 50% of the people don't vote, but they somehow disappear from political coverage. That's one thing. And the other thing is that I started to if you look closely at some magazine coverage, you'll start to notice that there are some polling agencies who are beginning to get reporting credits in some stories. In Time magazine, for instance, there's a polling agency that it not only did it do a poll for the magazine, but it also dug up real people for the reporters to talk to.
It's so hard to find real people.
Right, exactly. And I asked them, I said, where did you find these real people? They're like, well, we just kind of went out in the street and we found them, So now the reporters don't even have to do that. They can actually hire out that job.
Everything is outsourced these days.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, author of the newly released Spanking the Donkey, Dispatches from the Dumb Season, his reporting on the reporting on the 2004 presidential campaign. Well, you made a point of talking to a lot of those non-voters. When you were on a very low budget covering the thing for New York Press, you were in a flop house in Manchester.
Yeah, I was living in like a halfway house that was full of ex-cons. You know, and then in the beginning, it was kind of a funny contrast because when I first started doing the campaign stuff, I was absolutely flat broke. But I also made it a point, you know, to live with a different sort of people and run with a different crowd than the rest of the journalists were, just so that I could get a contrast with it. But then, you know, the instant I started working for Rolling Stone and I was in the major, you know, I was traveling with John Kerry, there's just no possibility of doing that. I went straight from the gutter to living in 5-star hotels and, you know, having, you know, 6 buffet meals a day. And going, so I went straight from you know, to lap of luxury.
I think a lot of the public doesn't realize how pampered the reporters are when they're covering events like that. You know, people who might live ordinary middle class lives when they're not on the campaign trail, suddenly eating well and sleeping well and.
Well, you know, it goes beyond the fact that they're pampered. The economics of campaign coverage is an enormous factor in who gets to actually cover the campaign. I mean, you know, the only reason I got to actually do some work before I started working for Rolling Stone and some other major organizations was that during the primary season when you're in New Hampshire, it's a small state and you can just live in one place and follow the candidates around. Once the campaign starts to go national, the only people who can really cover the campaign at all are people who are backed by major, you know, corporate media. And if you want to be on the candidate's plane, you're talking about a tab that's going to run between $1,500 or $2,000 a day minimum. And then beyond that, if you want to be in the rotating press pool, the people who actually get to spend a lot of time with the candidate, you have to be a regular on that plane. So you're talking about somebody who's going to be on there for months at a time. So unless you have, you know, $200,000 or $300,000, you're not going to have that close access to the candidate.
And of course, you have to be utterly conventional and reliable, right?
Well, it so happens that most of the people who have that kind of access or have that kind of funding tend to be those kind of conventional, reliable people. I mean, you're not going to see, you know, Al Goldstein and Screw Magazine spending $500,000 to hang around with John Kerry. It's just not going to happen.
That I might like to see. So what is Kerry like up close?
You know, like any good politician, he's up close. He's exactly the same as he is from a distance. You know, Kerry looks like the kind of person who decided that he was going to run for president since he could walk. So I think the instinct to utter an uncautious word probably disappeared with this guy somewhere in grade school, I would imagine. I mean, he wanders back into the plane occasionally, and other candidates that I spent time with had a human side, but John Kerry, you know, immediately started talking about the Red Sox. You know, he was always trying to remind the reporters that he had a sporty human side, and he always saw these opportunities to talk off the record with the journalists as a way to further that particular message. So, you know, you never really saw a relaxed, unguarded John Kerry. He does throw a nice football, though, I have to say. I played a little catch with him on the tarmac once, and he's got a good arm.
He is supposed to be a pretty accomplished athlete, right?
Well, he's all right. Let's put it that way.
I think the editor of Sports Illustrated said that he was the better of the two athletes.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But it didn't work for him. All that calculation and all that caution, and he lost. And you've actually got a couple of passages in the book where you lower the hard-bitten exterior and talk about love and peace and things like that.
That's probably not suitable for radio. It's too soupy. I mean, let's get to the sexy stuff. I don't know. And John Kerry, he was just such a canned, you know, paint by numbers politician, and he just didn't stand for anything. You know, I think just watching so much of this campaign, almost all of the energy from the Democratic side was just about hating George Bush and getting rid of this guy, and let's do anything we can to get over. Let's stick Wes Clark in there. Let's stick John Kerry in there because he carried a gun once, you know, or whatever it was, whatever the rationale.
As one of his advisors told the Times Magazine, he's looked a man in the eyes and shot him.
Yeah, exactly.
That's part of his qualifications for being president.
Right, right. And they're even going beyond this now. I mean, did you read the stuff in Jeff Goldberg's piece about the national security Democrats, like with Joe Biden? And they're now saying that Kerry should have gotten up and said, you know, I'm going to kill Bin Laden personally, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff. So, again, you know, it was this pure, disgusting calculation. And I think a lot of the thing that was so revolting about that is that this idea that we're going to get a tough guy to go up and – and stand up to George Bush. It had a lot of the same dynamic as like a weakling in elementary school who gets a big goon to take on the school bully. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, the thing about the Democrats is should have been, you know, fight the bully yourself. You know, don't get some clown to who happens to have served in the military to be your candidate just because you can't face, you don't have anything to stand for. You know.
And as you point out, the Republicans do stand for something, however weird or repulsive it may be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I did also in this book, I did a stint where I was undercover with, I worked as an operative for George Bush in Orlando. And, you know.
Yeah, there's a very interesting description of the contrast in the cultures where, like, the Democratic campaign staffers are wisecracking smartasses.
Yeah.
The Republicans are just plain folks. And, you know, that we've got this stock image of the Democrats as the party of the people and the Republicans as the
right.
elitists. But on the ground, it's not like that, right?
It's totally not like that. I mean, every time you walk in, except for Dennis Kucinich's campaign, where I have to say everybody was really committed, really earnest and sincere and the politics was really what it was all about for those people. If you went into pretty much any Democratic campaign office, it was like walking into a MASH sitcom. You know what I mean? Everybody was like ensemble cast, witticizing from 1 minute to the next. And all they would talk about is whether, you know, for instance, the Gephardt people in New Hampshire were just so pleased that they had an RV campaign vehicle while Joe Lieberman had a PT Cruiser. So they had a better car than the other candidate, you know. And it was just all about the technology of campaigning and whether we're going to get over or not. Whereas when you worked with the, you know, Bush, people were there. They were working for George Bush because they had stuff they really believed in, and it was, they were just regular people.
Some of it kind of nutty. That guy who was obsessed with cloning, right? The deputy sheriff.
Yeah, that guy's crazy. A guy came in while I was volunteering. I was sort of managing an office for Bush. And he came in with this.
And you, a guy, just came out of nowhere. And there was actually not much on the ground.
Yeah, there was no campaign at all. I got there in June in the I-4 corridor, which is like a critical part of the whole election. And when I volunteered, there was only one or two volunteers in the Bush campaign. So I ended up being a pretty important person in the Bush campaign. And I'm proud to say that we did very well in that area, that George Bush really swept the I-4 corridor. And I think that was a turning point for the election. So I like to think that I take some credit for that.
But what motivated the people who had volunteered? What were the issues that drove them to volunteer for Bush?
Well, mostly they would read Fox News and they'd watch Fox News and they'd see Sean Penn or some horrible liberal on television, and they just felt like they had to get rid of those people somehow. And they would storm into the offices and say, "We have to protect our country from these dreadful, coastal subversives." So that was pretty much the tenor of the conversation tended to revolve around some kind of villain.
Yeah, they thrive on being outraged at some sort of threatening enemy figure, right?
Right, yeah, it's always something, you know. And it was great because, you know, my cover down there was that I was a New York City school teacher on vacation for the summer. I was spending the summer in Orlando with a girlfriend, I said. So I would just tell them tales about what life was like in a New York City school and how it was just run
Your
by
transvestite.
Yeah, transvestites roaming the halls, you know, with whiskers sticking out of their pancake makeup and stuff like that. And people were just enthralled.
And they loved it.
Oh, they loved it. They just couldn't get enough of it. In fact, it really strained my creative powers to come up, you know, from day to day with a new tale of how terrible New York City was. But yeah, they eat that stuff up. So,
but towards the end of the book, you've got something about how a lot of the, you know, the red state voters sort of greedy individualism as this, you know, the blue state's product, and there actually is some kind of protest against this competitive society that we live in. Did you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I mean. I guess the best way to get at that is that they think that you know, in the northern cities and that in the blue state areas, that people aren't concerned about family, that they don't have a vision for the home so much as they do individual accomplishment and wealth and making money and being cool. Being cool is a very big thing with down there. They accuse Democrats and liberals of being really into image and body image and all these things. They think stuff like men's health and you know, all of that, the sort of ethos of the personal appearance is a creature of liberalism. And, you know,
that hate Williamsburg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, T-shirts that mean something, that would be a definite bugbear with those people. But yeah, they, you know, and it's funny because I think of people on our side of the equation tend to think that all this stuff is some corporate imposed, you know, all the stuff about body image and consumerism, that we think that's the other side's fault, but they think it's our fault. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, what about the Tom Frank argument that Republicans have pulled this great confidence trick by using the cultural wars as a way of sort of bait and switch tactics of getting people to vote against their own material interests, and it's really all about a corporate agenda, and this is a big trick that's being played on the red state masses. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. Doesn't it make sense to you?
Yeah.
I mean,
but these people feel very passionately about these so-called cultural issues.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a number of times, when I was with the Bush people, I would go out to dinner or I'd go visit somebody at their home. And they'd have been unemployed for years, you know, or have absolutely no money, or they're eating, the cheapest food, and they don't have enough money for their utilities, and all they want to talk about is gay marriage, you know, so you take these people who've been economically devastated, even in a place like Orlando that has a kind of a fake economy that doesn't have to compete with foreign manufacturing so much because it's all revolving around the theme parks. Even those people, the jobs are so scarce and they have no benefits and no health insurance, but that stuff doesn't worry them. All they really want to talk about is this cultural stuff and religion and those things. And even the black population down in Florida was really coming around, I thought, to the Republican message by the time I left. And I think that's, we're going to see more of that.
Is there any way to crack that with some better politics, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
you're a big fan of Kucinich.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I think the problem is that there's no possibility for the Democrats to really crack it because economically they're so identical right down the line with the Democrat with the Republicans. If they could argue, believably that they were somehow going to do more to protect the export of jobs overseas, or they were going to do more to give you health insurance or benefits, then maybe they'd have a case. But since they don't actually do those things, it's impossible for them to make that argument. So they have to, they have to stick to the few narrow issues that they think that they're going to win on, and they're not going to go over down there.
And what about Dennis Kucinich? He comes across as a kind of one of the
great
few
guy.
Admirable figures in the book.
But
he's also his dorkiness limited his popular appeal, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, Dennis has a problem. A number of times I would talk to him, and while he'd be eating his vegan ready food, and he just kept falling out of his mouth. You know, he's okay. He's a rare creature in politics in that he's a completely honest person, and he's completely devoid of calculation. But I remember being at this one event in New Hampshire where all these kids at the University of New Hampshire were listening to Kucinich talk, and they were completely enthralled by him, because he's the only politician who doesn't talk down to his audiences. He's not condescending at all. And this one kid was who seemed to be really, in love with Kucinich afterwards. I said, "So you're going to vote for him?" He goes, "No, we're going to have to go with someone tall." ultimately, again, that's another theme of the election, is that people will vote for who they think other people will vote for. So they won't vote for their own guy. They're going to vote for who they think, somebody in Kansas is going to vote for.
Yeah, they used to have newspaper contests in Britain in the 30s where the job wasn't to pick the most beautiful woman on the page. It was to pick who you thought was – the other people thought was.
Right, exactly.
Anticipating what a common opinion is going to be, which –
Which John. Explains John Edwards perfectly. I mean, he seemed to be everybody's second choice everywhere, because everybody thought that he was going to do well somewhere else. So that seemed to be the source of his popularity.
So would you ever do it again?
Man, I don't know. I'd have to have better drugs the next time if I were going to do it. I mean, I think I could probably do it, but I'd have to figure out a different way to go about it, because this business of being on the plane or following a major candidate around for a long period of time, there's just literally nothing to get in that environment. It's just impossible to do. So you'd have to take an unconventional approach to it. I mean, I tried a number of different things, but I'd have to come up with something different.
And were there any humane people in the press corps, or are they all robots?
A lot of them were sort of like, I guess it was probably a little bit like, Nazi Germany or any totalitarian state where, you know, occasionally, you know, one of the oppressors would sort of whisper to you under his breath that, you know, he feels sorry for Jews too or something like that. It was kind of like that in the Kerry plane. There were a couple of people who were campaign aides who would quietly sort of whisper to you that, yeah, I know this whole thing is totally ridiculous, but, you know, it's my job, so, you know, let's be quiet about it. One guy, Jim Loftus, was hilarious. He was one of Kerry's aides. He, when we were toasting somebody, one of the journalists who was leaving the trail, he said that, you know, we all work for evil corporations, but not all of us can be big evil people. Some of us have to be content with being small evil people. And so let's drink to this. And this is an example of a small evil person. So let's drink to the small evil people. But that was one of the funnier toasts that I
Yeah, a moment of truth in a tissue of lies.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thanks for joining us, Matt Taibbi. Matt Taibbi's new book, just off the new press, is called Spanking the Donkey, Dispatches from the Dumb Season. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this little excerpt from...
You going to pronounce this right this time?
I'm going to avoid pronouncing the artist's name this time. Same as last time, Partita number 2, the fourth movement, Bach solo violin. Thank you.